Why don't we get down to business? Belgorath suggested. Very well. I have something you want, and you have something I want. I think a trade is in order. Why don't we discuss that? Silk said, his eyes suddenly brightening, and his long nose twitching. I'm very much aware of your reputation, Prince Keldar. I'm not foolish enough to try to bargain with you.
All right. Just what is this thing you want from us, Zadi?
Belgorath asked the dead-eyed eunuch.
You are on your way out of Nyssa. I want you to take me with you. In exchange, I will tell you everything I have learned about Zandramas.
Totally out of the question.
I think you are speaking in haste, ancient one. Hear me out first.
I don't trust you, Sadi, Belgorath said bluntly.
That is quite understandable. I am not the sort of man who should be trusted.
Then why should I saddle myself with you?
Because I know why you are following Zandramas. And more importantly, I know where Zandramas is going. It is a very dangerous place for you. But I can arrange a way for us to move around freely once we get there. Now, why don't we put aside all of this childishness about trusting each other and get down to business?
We're just wasting time here, Belgorath said to the rest of them.
I can be very useful to you, ancient one.
Or to anyone who might want to know where we are, Silk added.
That would not be in my own best interests, Keldar.
Which brings up an interesting point. I have a splendid opportunity here to turn a quick profit. You mentioned the fact that there's a large price on your head. If you don't want to be cooperative, I might just decide to collect that price. How much did you say that it was?
You won't do that, Keldar, Zadi replied placidly. You are in a hurry to catch up with Zandramas, and there are always 100 administrative details involved in collecting a reward. It would probably be a month before you saw any of the money, and Zandramas would be that much farther ahead of you by then.
Oh, that's probably true, Silk admitted. He reached for one of his daggers with a regretful expression. There's this other alternative, however. Messy, but usually fairly effective. Sally backed away from him.
Belgorath,
he said in a faintly alarmed voice.
That won't be necessary, Silk, the old man said.
He turned to Polgara.
See what you can do, Paul.
All right, father. She turned to the eunuch. Sit down, Sadi. I want you to look at something.
Of course, Lady Polgara,
he agreed amiably, seating himself in a chair by the table. Look closely, she said, making a curious gesture in front of his eyes. The eunuch continued to smile.
How charming, he murmured,
looking at something which seemed to have appeared before his eyes.
Can you make it do any other tricks, too?
She bent forward and looked closely into his eyes. I see. You are more clever than I thought, Sadi. She turned back to the rest of them. He is drugged. Probably what he drank out of that flask. Right now there is absolutely nothing I can do with him. That takes us back to the other alternative, doesn't it? Silk said, reaching for his dagger again. Polgara shook her head. Right now he wouldn't even feel it.
Oh, Sadi said in a disappointed voice. You made it go away, and I rather liked it. The drug won't last forever, Silk shrugged. And by the time it wears off, we should be far enough from the city to be able to carve some answers out of him without the screams attracting too much attention. His hand strayed again to the hilt of his dagger. Aelorns, the dry voice in Garion's mind said disgustedly. Why is it that your solution to every problem comes out of a scabbard? What? Tell the little thief to put away his knife. But don't argue with me, Garion. You have to have Zadie's information about Zandromas, and I cannot give it to you. You're not suggesting that we take him along?
Garion was profoundly shocked at the idea.
I'm not suggesting anything, Garion. I'm telling you. Zadie goes along. You cannot do what you have to do without him. Now, tell your grandfather. He's not going to like it. I can face that prospect with enormous fortitude.
Then the voice was gone.
Grandfather?
Garion said in a sick tone. What? The old man's tone was testy.
Well, this isn't my idea, Grandfather, but...
Garion looked at the dreamy-faced eunuch with distaste, and then lifted his hands helplessly.
You're not serious, Belgareth exclaimed after a moment.
I'm afraid so.
Am I missing something?
Sadie asked curiously.
Shut up!
Belgareth snapped. Then he turned back to Garion.
Are you absolutely sure?
Garion nodded dejectedly.
This is sheer idiocy.
The old man turned and glared at Zadie. Then he reached across the table and took the front of the eunuch's iridescent robe in his fist.
Listen to me very carefully, Zadie,
he said from between clenched teeth.
You are going with us. But you keep your nose out of that flask. Do you understand me?
Of course, ancient one,
the eunuch replied in that same dreamy voice.
I don't think you fully grasp what I'm talking about,
Belgareth continued in a dreadfully quiet voice.
If I catch you with your brains full of dandelion fluff just once, I will make you wish that Keldar had gotten to you with his knife first. Do you follow me?
Zadie's eyes grew wide and his face blanched.
Yes, Belgareth, he stammered fearfully.
Good. Now, start talking. Just exactly what do you know about Zandromas?
Chapter 8
It all started last year,
Zadie began, still eyeing Belgareth apprehensively.
A Malorian posing as a jewel merchant came to Stithistor and sought out my chief rival at the palace, a petty schemer named Saris. It was rather general knowledge that Saris had long coveted my position, but I hadn't gotten around to having him killed yet.
He made a face.
A grave... oversight, as it turned out. Anyway, Saris and the Malorian negotiated for a bit, and the bargain they struck had nothing to do with gemstones. This so-called jeweler needed something that only someone in a position of authority could provide. So he gave Saris... certain information that Saris was able to use to discredit me and usurp my position.
I just love politics, don't you? Silk said to no one in particular. Zadie grimaced again.
The details of my fall from the Queen's favor are tedious, he continued. And I really don't want to bore you with them. At any rate, Saris supplanted me as chief eunuch, and I barely escaped from the palace with my life. Once Saris had consolidated his position, he was able to keep his part of the bargain that he reached with his Malorian friend.
And what exactly did the Malorian want? Silka asked.
This, Prince Keldar,
Zadi said, rising and going to his rumpled cot. He drew a carefully folded parchment from beneath the mattress and handed it to the little man. Silk read it quickly and then whistled.
Well, Belgareth said.
It's an official document, Silk replied. At least it's over the Queen's seal. Early last spring, Zalmisra dispatched a diplomatic mission to Sindaria.
That's fairly routine, Silk.
Oh, I know, but there are also some secret instructions to the diplomats. She tells them that they will be met at the mouth of the River of the Serpent by a foreigner, and that they are to render this stranger every possible aid. The gist of the whole thing is that these diplomats were to make arrangements to get the foreigner to the part of Heidelberg on the west coast of Carrick, and to have a Nyssen ship standing off the Riven coast on a certain date about the middle of last summer.
Coincidence, perhaps, Belgarath suggested.
Silk shook his head and held up the parchment. It identifies the foreigner by name. The diplomats were supposed to identify their passenger by the name Zandramas.
Well, that explains a few things, doesn't it? Geryon said.
May I see that? Polgara asked. Silk handed her the parchment. She looked at it briefly and then held it out to Zadi.
Are you positive that this is Zalmisra's seal?
There is no question about it, Polgara, and no one dares to touch that seal without her consent.
I see.
How did you come by the document, Zadi? Silk asked curiously.
4 copies of all official documents are routinely made, Prince Keldar. It is one of the resources of those with access to the Queen's favor. The purchase price of the extra copies has been established for centuries.
All right, Geryon said. So Zandramas came to Nyssa posing as a merchant, arranged to have Tsaras replace you as chief eunuch, and somehow managed to get Zalmisra to issue that order. Is that it?
It is not quite that simple, Belgarian. The Malorian merchant was not Zandramas. No one here in Stithistor ever saw Zandramas. The stranger the document talks about joined the diplomats on their way to Sindaria. So far as I have been able to determine, Zandramas never passed through Stithistor. Not only that, but after the arrangements for the ship to Hallberg had been made, all the diplomats conveniently died. They were stopping over at an inn in Kamar on their way to the capital, and there was a fire in the middle of the night. No one escaped the fire.
Oh, that's got a familiar ring to it, Silk said.
All right, then. Who was the Malorian jeweler?
Zadi spread his hands helplessly.
I was never able to find out, he confessed.
Did you ever see him?
Once. He was a strange-looking fellow. His eyes were absolutely colorless.
There was a long pause, and then Silk said,
Well, that clears up a few other things, doesn't it?
Maybe so, Geryon said.
But it still doesn't answer my main question. We know who Narados is working for now. We know how Zandramas got to Carrick and escaped from the Isle of the Winds with my son. But what I need to know is where the trail we're following is going to lead.
Zadi shrugged.
Rak Vakat.
How did you arrive at that conclusion? Silk asked him.
Saras hasn't been in power long enough to weed out the more untrustworthy of his underlings. I found one who was open to the notion of private enterprise, Zandramas has to be in Meloria with Prince Garen by this coming spring, and the route must be by way of Rak Vokat.
Wouldn't it be shorter to sail from Rakhtan? Sari looked at him with a faintly surprised expression.
I thought you knew. Kalzakath has put a very handsome price on the head of Zandramas, and the Malorian reserves are concentrated at Rahaga. If Zandramas tried to go through Haga to Rikhtan, all those troops would drop whatever they were doing to go headhunting. The only safe port for Zandramas to sail from is Rak Vakat.
Was this underling you bribed reliable? Silk demanded.
Of course not. As soon as he had finished telling me all of this, he had planned to turn me in for the reward. Dead, naturally. So he didn't really have any reason to lie to me, and he was too stupid to make up a coherent lie anyway.
The eunuch smiled bleakly.
I know of a certain plant, though. It is a very reliable plant. The man was telling me the absolute truth. As a matter of fact, he kept telling me the truth long after it had begun to bore me. Saras provided Zandramas with an escort across Naissa and detailed maps of the shortest route to the Isle of Vakat.
Was that all the fellow said?
Oh, no, Belgarian. He was busy confessing to me that he had cheated on an examination in school when I finally had Isis cut his throat. I can only deal with so much truth in one day.
All right, Geryon said, ignoring that. Zandramas is going to the Isle of Vakat. How does that help us?
The route Zandramas will have to follow will be roundabout, because of that reward I mentioned. We, on the other hand, can go straight across southern Thalmurgos to the isle. It will save us months.
That route goes right through the war zone, Silk protested.
That is no particular problem. I can take you directly through to Vakat without any hindrance from either the Murgos or the Melorians.
How do you propose to manage that?
When I was younger, I was engaged in the slave trade in Thalmurgos. I know all the routes, and I know whom to bribe and whom to avoid. Slavers are useful to both sides in the war between the Murgos and the Malorians, so they are allowed to move around freely. All we have to do is dress as slave traders, and no one will interfere with us.
Wants to keep you from selling us to the Grolems as soon as we cross the border.
Self-interest, Sadi shrugged. Grolems are an ungrateful lot. If I sell you to them, it is quite likely that they will turn around and sell me to Salmisra. I don't think I would like that at all.
Is she really that angry with you?
Irritated. A snake does not really get angry. I have heard, however, that she wants to bite me personally. Oh, that is a great honor, of course, but one I would rather forego.
The door to the hidden room clicked open, and Droblek looked in.
Isis is back, he said.
Good, Belgrath replied. I want to get back across the river before morning. The one-eyed man came in carrying the case Tzadi had described. It was flat, a square box a couple of feet across and several inches thick.
"What's in this, Tzadi?" he asked. "It gurgles,"
he took the case.
"Be careful, man. Some of those bottles are fragile."
"What is this?" Belgrath demanded.
"A bit of this, a bit of that," Sadi replied evasively.
"Drugs?"
"And poisons, and antidotes. A few aphrodisiacs, an anesthetic or two, a fairly effective truth drug, and zith."
What is Zith?
Zith is a who, ancient one, not a what. I never go anywhere without her.
He opened the case and lovingly took out a small earthenware bottle, securely corked and with a series of small holes encircling its neck.
"Would you hold this, please?" he said, handing the bottle to Silk. "I want to make sure Isis did not break anything."
He began to carefully examine the row after row of little vials nested in velvet-lined pockets inside the case. Silk looked curiously at the bottle, then took hold of the cork.
"I really would not do that, Prince Geldar," Zadi advised. "You might get a nasty surprise."
"What's in here?" Silk asked, shaking the bottle.
"Please, Geldar. Zith becomes vexed when people shake her."
Zadi closed the case, set it aside, and took the bottle from Silk.
"There, there," he said in a crooning voice. "It's nothing to be alarmed about, dear. I'm right here, and I won't let him disturb you any more."
From inside the bottle came a peculiar purring sound.
"How did you get a cat in there?" Geryon asked.
"Oh, Zith is not a cat, Belgarion," Zadi assured him. "Here, I'll show you."
Carefully, he worked the cork out and laid the bottle on its side on the table.
"You can come out now, dear," he crooned to it.
Nothing happened.
"Come along now, Zith, don't be shy."
Then a small, bright green snake slithered obediently from the mouth of the bottle. She had gleaming yellow eyes and a vibrant red stripe running down her back from nose to tail. Her forked tongue flickered out, touching Zadi's outstretched hand. Silk recoiled with a sharp intake of breath.
"Isn't she beautiful?" Zadi said, gently stroking the little snake's head with one finger.
The snake began to purr contentedly, then raised her head, fixed Silk with a cold reptilian eye, and hissed spitefully at him.
"I do believe that you offended her, Prince Geldar. Maybe you should stay away from her for a while."
"Oh, don't worry," Silk said fervently, backing away. "Is she venomous?"
"She is the deadliest little snake in the world, aren't you, dear?"
Zadi said, stroking the snake's head again.
"Also the rarest. Her species is highly prized in Nyssa because they are the most intelligent of all reptiles. They are friendly, even affectionate, and, of course, the purr is absolutely delightful."
"But she does bite," Silk added.
"Only people who irritate her, and never a friend. All you have to do is feed her and keep her warm and show her a little affection now and then, and she will follow you around like a puppy."
"Not me, she won't."
"Sorry," Belgareth said, pointing at the case. "What is the idea of all of this? I don't need a walking apothecary shop trailing along behind me."
Zadi held up one hand.
"Urkos are not really very interested in money, ancient one. But there are people I'll have to bribe when we go across K'tol Murgos. Some of them have picked up certain habits. That case is going to be worth more to us than a pack horse loaded down with gold."
Belgareth grunted. "Just keep your face out of it. I don't want your head full of smoke at a crucial moment. And keep your snake under control."
"Of course, Belgareth."
The old sorcerer turned to Isis.
"Can you get a bigger boat? We need to get back across the river, and that one of yours won't hold all of us."
Isis nodded. "Not just yet, father." "I am going to need him for a while," Paulgara said.
"Paul, we need to get back on the other side of the river before dawn."
"I won't be too long, father, but I have to go to the palace."
"The palace?"
"Zandramos went to Kerik, where no Angorak has been allowed since the days of Bear Shoulders. Salmisra arranged that, and she also engineered the escape from the Isle of the Winds after the abduction of Tenedra's baby. I want to know why."
We are a bit pressed for time, Pulgra. Can't this wait?
I don't think so, Father. I think we need to know if there were any other arrangements. I would rather not be surprised by a battalion or so of Nason troops lurking in the jungle along the trail we are following.
He frowned.
You might be right.
You're going to the palace?
Geryon asked her.
I must, dear.
All right, Geryon said, squaring his shoulders.
Then I am going with you.
She gave him a long, steady look.
You are going to insist, I take it?
He nodded.
Yes, Aunt Paul, I think I am,
he said it quite decisively. She sighed.
Oh, how quickly they grow up.
Then she turned to Isis.
Do you know a back way to the palace?
The one-eyed man nodded.
Will you show us?
Of course, he replied,
and then paused.
We can discuss the price later.
Price?
Nothing for nothing, lady. Shall we go?
It was nearly midnight when Isis led Pulgara and Geryon out the rear door of Droblek's house into a narrow alleyway that smelled strongly of rotting garbage. They made their way furtively through a twisting series of similar alleys, sometimes passing through the lower corridors of houses to move from one alley to another.
"How do you know which houses have unlocked doors?"
Geryon whispered, as they emerged from a tall, narrow house in a rundown quarter of the city.
"It is my business to know,"
Isis replied.
He straightened and looked around.
"We're getting close to the palace. The streets and alleys in this part of the city are patrolled. Wait here a minute."
He stealthily crossed the alley, opened a recessed door, and slipped inside. A couple of moments later he emerged, carrying two silk robes, a pair of lances, and a couple of brass helmets.
"Well, where are these?" he said to Geryon. "And if you don't mind, lady, pull your hood farther over your face. If anybody stops us, let me do the talking."
Geryon pulled on the robe and helmet and took one of the lances from the assassin.
"Tuck your hair up under the helmet,"
Isis instructed. Then he stepped out boldly, trusting to their disguises rather than to stealth. They had no sooner entered the next street than they were stopped by a half-dozen armed men.
"What's your business?"
the man in charge of the patrol demanded.
"We're escorting a visitor to the palace,"
Isis replied.
"What kind of visitor?"
Isis gave him a disgusted look.
"You don't really want to interfere, Corporal. The one she's visiting wouldn't like it."
"And who is that?"
"Now, that's a very stupid question, man. If this woman's friend finds out that I told you, we will probably both wind up in the river."
"Oh, do I know that you're telling me the truth?"
"You don't. But do you really want to take a chance on it?"
The corporal's expression grew faintly nervous as he thought about it.
"You'd better move along," he said finally.
"I was sure you would see it my way,"
Isis observed. He roughly took hold of Pulgra's arm.
"Move, you," he commanded.
When they reached the end of the street, Geryon glanced back. The soldiers were still watching them, but made no move to follow.
"I hope you are not offended, lady,"
Isis apologized.
"No," Pulgra replied. "You are a very resourceful fellow, Isis."
"That's what I get paid for. We go this way."
The wall of Salmisra's palace was very high, constructed of great rough-hewn stone blocks that had stood for aeons in this dank city by the river. Isis led them into the dense shadows under the wall and to a small iron-barred gate. He fumbled with the lock for a moment, then carefully swung the gate open.
"Let's go," he muttered.
The palace was a maze of dimly lighted corridors, but Isis led them confidently, moving along as if he were on an important mission. As they approached the broader, somewhat more brightly lighted hallways near the center of the palace,
A grotesquely made-up eunuch lurched by, his legs stiff and his eyes unfocused. His mouth was fixed in a stupefied grin, and his body twitched spasmodically as he stumbled past them. They passed an open doorway and heard someone inside giggling uncontrollably. Geryon could not be sure if that unseen person was a man or a woman. The one-eyed man stopped and opened a door.
"We have to go through here," he said, taking a smoky lamp from the niche beside the door. "Be careful. It is dark and there are snakes on the floor."
The room was cool and had a musty smell. Geryon could clearly hear the dry, dusty hiss of scales rubbing against each other in the corners.
"It was fairly safe," Isis said. "They were fed today, and that always makes them sluggish."
He stopped at the door, opened it a crack, and peered out.
"Wait,"
he whispered. Geryon heard a couple of men talking and the sound of their footsteps in the corridor outside. Then a door opened and closed.
"It's clear,"
Isis said quietly.
"Let's go."
He led them out into the corridor and along its dimly lighted length to a polished door. He looked at Polgara.
"Are you sure you want to see the queen?"
She nodded.
"All right. Saris is in here. He'll take us to the throne room."
"Are you sure?" Geryon whispered. Isis reached under the robe he had donned in the alley and drew out a long, saw-edged dagger.
"I can practically guarantee it. Give me a moment. Then come in and close the door."
He shoved the door open and jumped into the room like a great soft-footed cat.
"What?"
someone inside the room cried out in a high-pitched voice. Then there was a terrified silence. Geryon and Polgara entered quickly, closing the door behind them. A man sat at the table, his eyes bulging with fright and with the needlepoint of Isis's dagger pushed against his throat. He wore a crimson silk robe and his shaven head was pasty white. Rolls of greasy, unhealthy-looking fat drooped from his jowls, and his frightened eyes were small and pig-like. Isis was talking to him in a dreadfully quiet voice, emphasizing what he was saying by pressing the point of his knife into the skin of the fat man's throat.
"This is an Urgo knife, Tsaris. It causes almost no damage when it goes in. But when you pull it out, it jerks out all kinds of things along with it. Now, we aren't going to make any kind of an outcry, are we?"
No,
Sarah stammered in a squeaky voice.
"I was sure you would see it my way. This is what we're going to do. This lady and her young friend want to have a word with the queen. So you're going to take us to the throne room."
"To the queen?"
Saras gasped.
"No one goes into her presence without permission. I can't do it." "This conversation has suddenly taken a definite turn for the worse."
Isis looked over at Polgara.
"Would you like to turn your head, lady?"
he asked politely.
"The sight of a man with his brains oozing out of his ears makes some people queasy."
"Please,"
Saris begged him. "I can't. The queen will kill me if I take you into the throne room without being summoned." "And I will kill you if you don't. Somehow, I have got a feeling that this isn't going to be one of your good days, Saris. Now, get on your feet."
The assassin jerked the trembling fat man from his chair. They stepped out into the corridor with the eunuch leading the way. Sweat was streaming down his face, and there was a wild look in his eyes.
"No blunders, Taris," Isis warned. "Remember, I am right behind you."
The two burly guards at the entrance to the throne room bowed respectfully to the chief eunuch and swung the heavy doors open for him. Salmisra's throne room was unchanged. The enormous stone statue of Issa, the serpent god, still loomed behind the dais at the far end of the room. The crystal lamps still glowed dimly on their silver chains, and the 24 bald and crimson-robed eunuchs still knelt on the polished floor, ready to murmur in unison their phrases of adoration. Even the gold-framed mirror still stood on its pedestal at the sight of the divan-like throne. Salmisra herself, however, was dreadfully changed. She was no longer the beautiful, sensuous woman Geryon had seen when, drugged and bemused, he had first been led into her presence. She lay on her throne with her mottled coils undulating restlessly. Her polished scales gleamed in the lamplight, and her flat reptile's head rose on its long, thin neck. With the golden crown of the Serpent Queen resting lightly above her dead, incurious eyes. She glanced briefly at them as they entered, then turned back to regard her reflection in the mirror.
I do not recall having summoned you, Saris,
she said in a dry, dusty whisper.
The Queen questions the chief eunuch,
the 24 shaven-headed men kneeling near the dais intoned in unison.
Forgive me, Eternal Salmisra,
the eunuch pleaded, prostrating himself on the floor before the throne.
I was forced to bring these strangers into your presence. They threatened to kill me if I refused.
Then you should have died, Saris,
the serpent whispered.
You know that I do not like to be disturbed.
The queen is displeased, half of the kneeling eunuchs murmured.
Ah, the other half responded with a certain spiteful satisfaction. Salmisra swung her swaying head slightly to fix her eyes on Isis.
I seem to know you,
she said. The one-eyed man bowed.
Isis, your majesty, he replied. The assassin.
I do not wish to be disturbed just now,
the Serpent Queen told him in her emotionless whisper.
If that means that you are going to kill Saris, please take him out into the corridor to do it.
We will not disturb you for long, Salmisra, Polgara said, pushing back the hood of her cloak. The snake's head turned slowly, her forked tongue tasting the air.
Ah, Polgara,
she hissed, without any evident surprise.
It has been some time since your last visit.
Several years, Polgara agreed.
I no longer take note of the years.
Salmisra's dead gaze turned to Geryon.
And Belgarion,
she said.
I see that you are not a boy anymore.
No, he replied, fighting down an involuntary shudder.
Come closer,
she whispered.
Once you thought that I was beautiful and yearned for my kiss, would you like to kiss me now?
Geryon felt a strange compulsion to obey, and found that he could not take his eyes from those of the Serpent Queen. Not even aware that he did it, he took a hesitant step toward the dais.
The fortunate one approaches the throne,
the eunuchs murmured. Geryon, Polgara said sharply.
I will not hurt him, Polgara. I never intended to hurt him.
I have a few questions for you, Salmisra. Once you answer them, we will leave you to your entertainments.
What manner of questions, Polgara? What could I possibly know that your sorcery could not ferret out?
You recently met a Malorian named Naradus, a man with colorless eyes.
Is that his name? Saris never told me.
You made an arrangement with him.
Did I?
At his request, you sent diplomats to Sindaria. Among them was a foreigner named Zandramos. Your diplomats were instructed to give the foreigner every possible assistance in getting to Hulleberg on the west coast of Kerik. You also ordered a ship to the Isle of the Winds to bring Zandramos back to Nyssa.
I gave No such orders, Bulgara. I have no interest in the affairs of Zandramas.
The name is familiar to you?
Of course. I told you once that the priests of Angarak and the sorcerers of Aloria are not the only ones who can find a truth that lies hidden. I know of your desperate pursuit of the one who took Belgarion's son from the citadel at Riva.
But you say that you were in no way involved in the arrangements?
The one you call Naradus came to me with gifts,
Salmisra whispered,
but said nothing more than that he wished my permission to trade here Nyssa.
Then how do you explain this? Aunt Paul took the parchment sheet Sadi had given her from under her cloak. Salmisra flicked her tongue at one of the kneeling eunuchs.
Bring it to me,
she ordered. The eunuch leaped to his feet, took the parchment from Aunt Paul, then knelt on the edge of the dais, holding the sheet open and extended toward his queen.
This is not the order I gave,
Salmisra said flatly, after the briefest of glances.
I ordered the diplomats to Sindaria. Nothing more. Your copy is not accurate, Bulgara.
Would the original be about anywhere? Geryon asked her.
Tsaris should have it.
Geryon looked at the fat eunuch groveling on the floor. Where is it? He demanded. Tsaris stared at him. Then his gaze went in terror to the enthroned serpent. Geryon considered several alternatives, but discarded most of them in favor of simplicity. Make him talk, Isis, he said shortly. The one-eyed man stepped over, straddled the trembling eunuch, and grasped his chin firmly from behind. Then he pulled up sharply until Saras was arched backward. The saw-edged dagger made a steely grating sound as it came out of its sheath.
Wait, Saras begged in a choked voice. It's in the drawer at the bottom of my wardrobe in my room.
Your methods are direct, assassin,
the queen observed.
I am a simple man, your majesty,
Isis replied.
I do not have the temperament for subtlety, nor intricacy. I have found that directness saves time in the long run.
He released the terrified Saras and pushed his Ulgo dagger back into its sheath. He looked at Geryon.
Do you want me to get the parchment?
He asked. I think we are going to need it.
All right.
Isis turned and left the room.
An interesting man,
Salmisra noted. She bent and caressingly touched her mottled coils with her blunt nose.
My life is much changed since you were last here, Bulgara,
she whispered in her dusty voice.
I am no longer driven by those hungers I had before, but pass my days instead in restless doze. I lull myself into slumber with the sweet sound of my own scales caressing each other. As I sleep, I dream. I dream of mossy caves in deep, cool forests. And I dream of the days when I was still a woman. But sometimes in my dreams, I am a bodiless spirit, seeking out the truths that others would hide. I know of the fear which lies in your heart, Bulgara, and the desperate need that drives Zandramas. I even know of the terrible task which lies upon Tiradus.
But you still say that you are not involved in this matter?
I have no interest in it. You and Zandramas can pursue each other across all the kingdoms of the world, but I am incurious as to the outcome."
Aunt Paul's eyes narrowed as she looked at her.
"I have no reason to lie to you, Polkara,"
Samisra said, sensing the suspicion in the look.
"What could Sandra Moss possibly offer me that would buy my aid? All of my needs are satisfied, and I no longer have desires."
Her blunt head came up and her tongue flickered.
"I rejoice, however, that your quest has brought you again into my presence, so that I may gaze once more upon the perfection of your face."
Polgara's chin lifted. "Look quickly, then, Salmisra. I have little patience for the involuted amusements of a snake."
"The centuries have made you waspish, Polgara. Let us be civil to one another. Would you like to have me tell you what I know of Sandra Moss? She is no longer what she once was."
"She?" Geryon exclaimed.
"You did not even know that,"
the serpent hissed maliciously.
"Your sorcery is a sham, then, Polgara. Could you not sense your enemy is a woman? And did you perhaps not even realize that you have already met her?"
"What are you talking about, Salmisra?"
"Poor dear Polkara. The long, long centuries have filled your wits with cobwebs. Did you really think that you and Belgarath are the only ones in the world who can change their shapes? The dragon who visited you in the mountains above Arindia appears quite different when she resumes her natural form."
The door to the throne room opened and Isis came back in, holding a parchment sheet with a red wax seal on the bottom of it.
"Bring it to me,"
Samisra commanded. Isis looked at her, his single eye narrowing as he gauged the distance between the serpent's throne and his own unprotected skin. Then he went over to the prostrate eunuch who had presented Polgara's document to the queen. Without changing expression, he kicked the man solidly in the ribs.
"Here," he said, thrusting out the parchment. "Take this to Her Majesty."
"Are you afraid of me, Isis?"
Salmisra asked, sounding faintly amused.
"I am unworthy to approach you too closely, my queen."
Salmisra bent her head to examine the parchment the trembling eunuch held out for her to read.
"There appears to be some discrepancy,"
she hissed.
"This document is the same as the one you showed me, Polgara. But it is not the document to which I ordered my seal affixed. How is this possible?"
"May I speak, my queen?"
the eunuch who held the parchment asked in a quavering voice.
"Of course, Addis,"
she replied almost pleasantly.
"So long as you realize that if your words displease me, the kiss I will give you in payment will bring you death."
Her forked tongue flickered out toward him. The eunuch's face went a ghastly gray color, and his trembling became so violent that he very nearly collapsed.
"Speak, Addis,"
she whispered.
"It is my command that you disclose your mind to me. We will determine then whether you live or die. Speak now."
"My queen," he quavered, "the chief eunuch is the only person in the palace permitted to touch your majesty's royal documents and seal. If the document in question is false, must we not look to him for an explanation?"
The serpent considered that, her head swaying rhythmically back and forth, and her forked tongue flickering. At last she stopped her reptilian dance and leaned slowly forward until her tongue brushed the cringing eunuch's cheek.
"Live, Addis,"
she murmured.
"Your words have not displeased me, and so my kiss grants the gift of life."
Then she reared her mottled form again and regarded Saras with her dead eyes.
"Do you have any explanation, Saras? As our most excellent servant Addis has pointed out, you are my chief eunuch. You affixed my seal. How did this discrepancy come to pass?"
"My queen,"
his mouth gaped open, and his dead white face froze in an expression of stark terror. The still-shaken Addis half-rose, his eyes filled with a sudden, wild hope. He held up the parchment in his hand and turned to his crimson-robed companions kneeling to one side of the dais.
"Behold," he cried in triumphant voice, "behold the proof of the chief eunuch's misconduct."
The other eunuchs looked first at Addis and then at the groveling and terrified chief eunuch. Their eyes also furtively tried to read the enigmatic expression on Salmisera's face.
"Ah,"
they said in unison at last.
"I'm still waiting, Saris,"
the serpent queen whispered. Saris, however, quite suddenly scrambled to his feet and bolted toward the throne room door, squealing in mindless animal panic. As fast as his sudden flight was, though, Isis was even faster. The shabby, one-eyed assassin bounded after the fleeing fat man, his horrid dagger leaping into his hand. With the other, he caught the back of the chief eunuch's crimson robe and jerked him up short. He raised his knife and looked inquiringly at Salmisera.
"Not yet, Isis," she decided. "Bring him to me."
Isis grunted and dragged his struggling captive toward the throne. Saris, squealing and gibbering in terror, scrambled his feet ineffectually on the polished floor.
"I will have an answer from you, Saris,"
Salmisera whispered. "Buck," Isis said in a flat voice, setting his dagger point against the eunuch's lower eyelid. He pushed slightly, and a sudden trickle of bright red blood ran down the fat man's cheek. Saris squealed and began to blubber.
"Forgive me, Your Majesty," he begged. "The Malorian Naradas compelled it of me."
"How did you do it, Saris?"
the serpent demanded implacably.
I put your seal at the very bottom of the page, divine Salmisera," he blurted. "Then when I was alone, I added the other orders."
"And were there other orders as well?" Aunt Paul asked him. "Will we encounter hindrances and traps on the trail of Zandramas?"
"No, nothing. I gave no orders other than that Zandramas be escorted to the Murgo border and provided the maps she required. I pray you, Your Majesty, forgive me."
"That is quite impossible, Saris. It had been my intention to hold myself aloof in the dispute between Bulgara and Zandramas. But now I am involved because you have abused my trust in you."
"Shall I kill him?" Isis asked calmly.
"No, Isis," she replied. "Saris and I will share a kiss, as is the custom in this place."
She looked oddly at him.
"You are an interesting man, assassin. Would you like to enter my service? I am certain that a position can be found for one of your talents."
Addis the eunuch gasped, his face suddenly going pale.
"But, Your Majesty,"
he protested, leaping to his feet.
Your servants have always been eunuchs, and this man is...
He faltered, suddenly realizing the temerity of his rash outburst. Salmisra's dead eyes locked on his, and he sank, white-faced, to the floor again.
You disappoint me, Addis,
she said in that dusty whisper. She turned back to the one-eyed assassin.
Well, Issus,
she said,
a man of your talents could rise to great eminence, and the procedure, I am told, is a minor one. You would soon recover and into the service of your queen.
Ah, I am honored, your majesty,
he replied carefully.
But I'd really prefer to remain more or less intact. There is a certain edge my profession requires, and I would rather not endanger that by tampering with things.
I see.
She swung her head briefly to look at the cowering Addis, and then back to the assassin.
You have made an enemy today, however, I think, and one that may someday grow quite powerful.
Issus shrugged. I've had many enemies, he replied. A few of them are even still alive.
He gave the cowering eunuch a flinty look.
If Addis wants to pursue the matter, he and I can discuss it privately some day, or perhaps late some night, when our discussions won't disturb anyone.
We must leave now, Polgara said. You have been most helpful, Salmisra. Thank you.
I am indifferent to your gratitude,
Salmisra replied.
I do not think that I will see you again, Bulgara. I think that Zandramas is more powerful than you, and that she will destroy you.
Only time can reveal that.
Indeed. Farewell, Polgara.
Goodbye, Salmisra. Polgara deliberately turned her back on the dais. Come along, Geryon. Issus?
Zaris,
Salmisra said in a peculiar, almost singing tone.
Come to me.
Geryon glanced back over his shoulder, and saw that she had reared her mottled body until it rose high above the dais and her velvet-covered throne. She swayed rhythmically back and forth. Her dead eyes had come alight with a kind of dreadful hunger, and they burned irresistibly beneath her scaly brows. Tsaras, his mouth agape, and with his pig-like eyes frozen, devoid of all thought, lurched toward the dais with jerky, stiff-legged steps.
Come, Zaris,
Salmisra crooned.
I long to embrace you and give you my kiss.
Aunt Paul, Geryon, and Issus reached the ornately carved door and went quietly into the corridor outside. They had gone no more than a few yards when there came from the throne room a sudden shrill scream of horror, dying hideously into a gurgling, strangled squeal.
I think that the position of chief eunuch just became vacant,
Issus observed dryly. Then, as they continued on down the dimly lighted hallway, he turned to Polgara.
Now, my lady,
he said, ticking the items off on his fingers.
First of all, there was the fee for getting you and the young man into the palace. Then there was the business of persuading Tsaris to take us to the throne room. And then...
Part 2. Rak Urga. Chapter 9. It was almost dawn when they crept quietly out of Droblek's house. A thick gray fog shrouded the narrow, twisting streets of Stithistor as they followed Issus through the shabby quarter near the docks. The smell of the river and the reek of the surrounding swamps lay heavy in the foggy darkness. filling Geryon's nostrils with the odors of decay and the stagnant water. They emerged from a narrow alleyway, and Issus motioned them to a halt as he peered into the mist. Then he nodded.
"Let's go," he whispered. "Try not to make any noise."
They hurried across a glistening cobblestone street lit by torches, each surrounded by a nimbus of hazy red light, and entered the deeper shadows of another garbage-strewn alley. At the far end of the alley, Geryon could see the slow-moving surface of the river sliding ponderously by, pale in the fog. The one-eyed assassin led them along another cobblestone street to the foot of a rickety wharf, jutting out into the fog. He stopped in the shadows beside a dilapidated shack that stood partially out over the water and fumbled briefly at the door. He opened it slowly, muffling the protesting creaking of a rusty hinge with a tattered piece of rag.
"In here,"
he muttered, and they followed him into the dank-smelling shack.
"There's a boat tied at the end of this wharf,"
he told them in a half-whisper.
"Wait here while I go get it."
He went to the front of the shack. Geryon heard the creak of hinges as a trap door opened. They waited, listening nervously to the skittering and squeaking of the rats that infested this part of the town. The moments seemed to creep by as Geryon stood watch beside the door, peering out through a crack between two rotting boards at the foggy street running along the edge of the river.
"All right,"
he heard Issus say from below, after what seemed like hours.
"Be careful on the ladder. The rungs are slippery."
One by one they climbed down the ladder into the boat that the one-eyed man had pulled into place under the wharf.
"We have to be quiet,"
he cautioned them, after they had seated themselves.
"There's another boat out there on the river somewhere."
"A boat?" Tsadi asked in alarm. "What are they doing?"
Issus shrugged.
"Probably something illegal."
Then he pushed his craft out into the shadows at the side of the wharf, settled himself on the center seat, and began to row, dipping his oars carefully into the oily surface of the river so that they made almost no sound. The fog rose from the dark water in little tendrils, and the few lighted windows high in the towers of Stifistor had a hazy unreality, like tiny golden candles seen in a dream. Issus rowed steadily, his oars making only the faintest of sounds. Then, from somewhere not far upstream, there was a sudden muffled outcry, followed by a splash and the gurgling sounds of bubbles rising to the surface.
"What was that?"
Tsadi hissed nervously, as Issus stopped rowing to listen.
"Be still,"
the one-eyed man whispered. From somewhere in the fog there came the thumping sound of someone moving around in a boat, followed by the splash of an awkwardly pulled oar. A man swore, his voice harsh and loud.
"Keep quiet,"
another voice said.
"What for? Let's not tell everybody in Stigistor that we are out here." "You'll worry too much. That rock I tied to his ankles will keep him down for a long time."
The creaking oarlocks faded off into the fog.
"Amateurs,"
Issus muttered derisively.
"An assassination, perhaps?"
Silk asked, with a certain professional curiosity.
"Or a private killing?"
"What difference does it make?"
Issus started to row again, his oars dipping slowly into the water. Behind them, Stithistor had disappeared into the fog. Without the reference point of its dim lights, it seemed to Geryon that they were not moving at all, but sat motionless on the surface of the dark river. Then, at last, a shadowy shore appeared ahead in the clinging fog. After a few more minutes, he was able to make out the hazy shape of individual treetops outlined by the pale mist. A low whistle came to them from the bank, and Issus angled their boat slightly, making for the signal.
"Geryon, is that you?"
Durnik whispered out of the shadows.
"Yes."
Issus pulled their boat under the overhanging branches, and Durnik caught the bow.
"The others are waiting on the far side of the road,"
he said quietly, as he helped Polgara from the boat.
"You've been most helpful, Isis," Toddy said to his hireling. The one-eyed man shrugged.
"Isn't that what you paid me for?"
Silk looked at him.
"If you decide to consider my offer, talk to Droblick."
"I'll think about it,"
Isis replied. He paused, then looked at Polgara.
"Good luck on your journey, lady," he said quietly. "I get the feeling, but you're going to need it."
"Thank you, Isis." Then he pushed his boat back out into the fog and disappeared.
"What was that all about?" Soddy asked Silk.
"Oh, nothing much. Drasnian intelligence is always looking for a few good men, that is all."
Durnik was looking curiously at the shaven-headed eunuch. "We'll explain when we get back to the others, dear," Polgara assured him.
"Yes, Paul," he agreed. "We go this way."
He led them up the brushy bank to the broken stones of the road, then pushed his way into the tangled undergrowth on the far side with the rest of them close behind. Tenedra, Eriond, Toth, and Velvet sat in a little hollow behind the moss-covered trunk of a fallen tree. A single well-shielded lantern gave forth a dim glow, illuminating the hollow with a faint light.
"Carrion!"
Tenedra exclaimed with relief, coming quickly to her feet.
"What took you so long?"
"We had to make a side trip," he replied, taking her into his arms. As he nestled his face into her hair, he found that it still had that warm, sweet fragrance that had always touched his heart.
"All right," Belgarath said, looking out into the tag end of the foggy night. "I want to get moving, so I'll keep this short."
He sat down on the spongy moss beside the lantern.
"This is Sadi," he pointed at the shaven-headed eunuch. "Most of you know him already. He will be going with us." "Is that altogether wise, Belgarath?"
Durnik asked dubiously.
"Probably not. But it wasn't my idea. He seems to feel that Zandramos has gone down into southern Tol Mergos and plans to cross the continent to the Isle of Verkat, off of the southeast coast."
"That is a very dangerous part of the world just now, Ancient One,"
Velvet murmured.
"We'll have no trouble, dear lady," Teddy assured her in his contralto voice. "If we pose as slavers, no one will interfere with us."
"So you say," Belgarath said somewhat skeptically. "It might have been true before the war started down there. But we still don't know for sure how the Malorians view the slave trade."
"There's one other thing you should all know," Polgara added quietly. "Geryon and I went to the palace to find out if Salmisra was involved in this in any way. She told us that Zandramos is a woman."
"A woman?"
Tenedra exclaimed. "That's what she said. And she had no reason to lie to us." Durnik scratched at his head.
"Well, that's a bit of a surprise, isn't it? Are you sure Salmisra knew what she was talking about?"
Polgara nodded. "She was very certain, and quite smug about the fact that she knew something that I did not."
"It does sort of fit," Velvet said thoughtfully. "Most of the things Zandramos has done were done the way a woman would do them."
"I can't quite follow that," Durnik admitted.
"A man does things one way, Gutman. A woman does them differently. The fact that Zandramos is a woman explains a great deal."
"She's also going to great lengths to conceal the fact," Silk added. "She's made sure that just about everybody who has seen her is not alive to tell anybody about it." "We can talk about all of this some more later," Belgarath said, standing up and looking around at the gradually lightening fog. "I want you to get away from this place before the people on the other side of the river start moving around. Let's saddle the horses."
It took a bit of readjustment of their equipment to free one of the pack horses for Sadi's use, but a short time later they rode out from their sheltered place of concealment and on along the weedy track that followed the winding course of the River of the Serpent. They moved at first at a cautious walk.
but once they had passed the outskirts of Stithi's Tor, lying hidden in the fog across the river, they picked up their pace to canter, clattering along the abandoned road that stretched through the rank jungle and reeking swamps of the land of the snake people. As the sun rose, it gave the fog surrounding them a kind of mystical glow, and the droplets hanging along the edges of individual leaves drooping from the undergrowth at the side of the road took on a jewel-like sparkle. Geryon, sandy-eyed and tired from a night without sleep, looked bemused at the jeweled green leaves, marveling that such beauty could exist in this stinking swamp.
"The whole world is beautiful, Belgarion,"
Heriand assured him in response to that unspoken thought.
"You just have to know how to look at it."
Once the fog had burned off, they were able to move at a much more rapid pace. They encountered no other travelers that day. By the time the sun began to sink into the heavy banks of purple cloud that seemed to hover perpetually over the western horizon, they were well upriver.
"How far is it to the Murgo border?"
Geryon asked Tsadi, as the two of them gathered firewood while Durnik and Toth set up the tents for the night's encampment.
"Several more days," the eunuch replied. "The highway fords the river up near the headwaters, and then angles down to Raga. There is a village on the other side of the ford. I'll need to stop there for a few things, suitable garments and the like."
Velvet and Zinedra were unpacking Pogra's cooking utensils not far away, and the blonde Drasnian girl looked over at Tsadi.
"Excuse me," she said.